Vice President Kamala Harris to run for Joe Biden's spot on the Democratic ticket.
58% of Democrats think Vice President Harris would make a good president, according to a new poll from AP North. Overall, 30% of Americans think she would.
Plus, Benjamin Netanyahu is coming to Washington.
He's also going to try to project to Israelis back home that he has not done damage to the U.S.-Israel relationship.
And later, we'll get an update from Kyiv, a look at the growing tension between Israel and the Houthis, and a dire warning on the situation in Sudan. Today is Monday, July 22nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. As you may have heard by now, President Joe Biden announced on Sunday afternoon that he's ending his re-election bid and endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris to be the Democratic Party's nominee in the November election. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has the details.
After weeks resisting questions of his mental acuity and insisting he would remain in the race, President Joe Biden announced he's ending his campaign and will not seek re-election in November. "It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president," he announced on social media just before 2 p.m. Sunday. Biden said while he had intended to seek re-election, he believes it is in the best interest of his Democratic Party and the country to stand down and focus solely on fulfilling his duties as U.S. president for the remainder of his term. Biden thanked Vice President Kamala Harris for being an extraordinary partner. In another social media post, he offered his full support and endorsement for Harris to be the party's nominee. Brookings Institution's Elaine Carmack is author of a book on how America nominates presidential candidates. She spoke via Skype.
Politically, it would be meaningful because these delegates are supportive of Joe Biden and they would certainly listen to him. But he can't automatically transfer his delegates to Harris or anybody else for that matter.
Almost all 3,896 Democratic delegates meeting at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois next month have pledged votes to Biden, who swept the primary contest in the country. But under DNC rules, those pledges can be changed. Calls for Biden to pass the torch grew louder in recent days, including from top Democratic lawmakers. 58% of Democrats think Vice President Harris would make a good president, according to a new poll from AP North. Overall, 30% of Americans think she would. If Democrats settle on Harris leading the presidential ticket, they must also select her running mate. Biden said he will speak to the American public later this week in more detail about his decision. Donald Trump, officially nominated by Republicans as their presidential nominee Thursday, issued his statement on social media. "Crooked Joe Biden was not fit to run for president and is certainly not fit to serve." Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Many in the Republican Party are echoing Donald Trump's message we just heard about from Patsy, saying that if Biden is not fit enough to run for president, he's not fit enough to continue being president and should resign, though there is no rule or law saying he must. In her first public address since taking over for Biden on the Democratic ticket, Vice President Kamala Harris spoke at a White House event on Monday to honor college athletes. She began by praising Joe Biden for his successes as president. Then, with words seemingly applicable to a presidential campaign, she praised the college athletes in attendance.
"So to all of our athletes, I know it was not easy to make it to this moment. Each of you has faced challenges and obstacles, and you have endured. You have fought back and fought through. By doing so, you demonstrated that true greatness requires more than skill. It requires grit and determination. You all know what it means to commit and to persevere. And you know what it means to count on teammates. During the course of a long season, sports teams become a family. You rely on each other. You develop relationships that will last a lifetime. And you make the people around you better in every way. And when you play, you inspire people across our nation. You remind all of us what can be achieved with hard work and ambition.
And to the disappointment of many, she did not mention the upcoming election or any aspect of the campaign. For some more insight and analysis on Biden's decision to withdraw from the race and what happens next, my colleague Scott Walterman spoke with Charles Chamberlain from Chamberlain PR. He served as a spokesperson and communication strategist for three U.S. senators and a speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives.
So let's start at the top. Not a surprise, but still nonetheless, if not shocking, unsettling, maybe?
I mean, if you're a traditionalist and you're someone that has watched politics or followed politics for the last, I don't know, 50, 40 years, this makes absolutely no sense to you. I mean, I've been involved in politics for almost 20 years, for over 20 years. And I'm one of those guys that kind of follows traditions, and people are telling me, you know, Biden's going to, she should drop out, or he's going to drop out, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, this is never going to happen. And I just didn't think that something like this could happen this day and age because of the political apparatus that you have to set up, the funding, the modeling for opposition research, and the staff being in place, and the beliefs behind it. It takes all this to coalesce behind one candidate. It's a lot. I mean, when you win, I don't care if you're looking at Clinton, you're looking at W. Bush, Bush 41. You know, it takes a tremendous amount of people coming together to get behind a candidate to actually win. And to do that in a matter of a day or even a couple weeks before I think it's 3 weeks before the DNC convention, it just seems improbable. But here we are. Here we are.
You know, the time for coyness is over. I understand that they've been making calls to delegates at the convention, getting them on board.
Yeah, and look, they've got the upper hand. It's not as if some sort of delegate list, contact list, or modeling exists, right? If you want to become president right now, you got to seek out every delegate that exists. It's over 4,000 or something like that. And Biden has them all. So they've got a huge upper hand when it comes to that, and they can make the calls, and they can get folks to coalesce. So, yeah, that's exactly what they should be doing right now.
Well, they've had a couple of weeks. This has been in the works for a couple of weeks now. This isn't coming. I mean, after he made the announcement, there were 40 press releases that were launched instantaneously.
I can't say that. The reason why I can't say that, as a longtime communications person, nobody. It just made the Democrats look disorganized, right? This is akin to the Republicans in the House, like, not being able to secure a speaker, right? Just nobody wants that kind of damage, political damage. And here's the thing, Kamala Harris, vice president, she's collateral damage because she's the vice president, right? She's sitting there while all this is happening. And yeah, sure, it's not her fault. But now you've got people talking about, you know, was she aware of the president's mental condition or health? Did she know that he wasn't fit for office? And, you know, Republicans are already beginning to tie her to all the chaos that existed ahead of what happened today.
That's VOA Scott Walterman speaking with political PR expert Charles Chamberlain. The U.S. presidential election has implications far beyond its borders, particularly when it comes to the fate of Ukraine and security of the European continent as a whole. President Biden's withdrawal from the race has raised concerns among the people in Ukraine about continued American support in its fight against Russia. VOA's Lori London spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for Reaction.
To be honest, for the past weeks, there were a lot of discussions around that Biden might withdraw from the election campaign and that there is no understanding who might replace him from the Democratic wing. On the other hand, Trump have already been nominated. Now there are a lot of discussions of who might replace him, and Ukrainians at this point are a little bit afraid that Trump might actually return to White House. However, also a lot of Ukrainians now think that might be also okay that he's coming back, because his unpredictability could be also in favor of Ukraine. And actually, President Zelensky also had a conversation with Donald Trump over the weekend. So basically, Ukrainians at this point are very unclear what's going to happen, and just hope that certain clarity will come soon.
President Biden has endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris to take his place. So from your perspective there, Ukrainians still feel sort of unsure about what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, of course, everyone know that Kamala Harris is the one who's been picked by Biden, and even she has very good reputation here in Kyiv, at least from what is discussed at this point. But again, Ukrainians still, you know, they're not sure that this would be the final candidate, because as we can see with Biden, everything could happen. So everyone is waiting for the end of August when official candidate will be announced.
What else can you tell us about the conversation that President Zelensky had with Donald Trump?
Well, in short, no much details, of course, been revealed. But what we know for sure, that the main topic for conversation was how to end hostilities, how to get to a certain peace formula and peace agreement with Russia. And according to the comments after the conversation, Trump and Zelensky discussed that mainly. And now it's really also a lot of curiosity here in Ukraine about how Trump might get to put both Zelensky and Putin, or representative of Ukraine and representative of Russia, at the table for negotiations, because he's been talking about this a lot, that he will end the war, but he never mentioned how exactly he would do this and why he's so sure that he can end this war.
Lori London hosts Flashpoint Ukraine. Here on VOA, she was speaking with our correspondent, Anna Chernikova, in Kyiv. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Tension between Israel and the Houthis in Yemen are on the rise after a series of attacks and retaliations. We'll hear more in a moment. First, though, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is headed to Washington on Monday. He'll address Congress on Wednesday. What do we expect to hear from him, and how might his message change now that Joe Biden is no longer running for a second term? I'm joined by Brian Katulis, a senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the Middle East Institute.
I think we're going to hear from Netanyahu statements that are similar to what we've heard before, that the United States needs to support Israel because the fight it is facing, not only with Hamas and Gaza, but with some of the other groups and countries like Iran in the region, is a fight that the United States has an interest in helping Israel win. And he's basically going to send a message of we need continued support. And he's also going to try to project to Israelis back home that he has not done damage to the U.S.-Israel relationship because of his actions last year on trying to make changes in their political system, and then also how he's handled the Israel-Hamas war. And I think a key objective of his is to send the message that he has not done damage to this relationship, despite perceptions that he's played some partisan games in who he aligns with and why he's even coming here at this time.
Well, those partisan games, I think, are going to be on full display. It was the Republicans who invited him to address Congress, not the Democrats, not Joe Biden. Can you speak to those divisions here, how support for Israel plays out in American politics?
Well, part of Netanyahu's legacy, and he's been the leader of Israel for many years and multiple times because he's been in and out of office. But part of his legacy as a leader of Israel has been to make the U.S.-Israel relationship a sharply partisan wedge issue in U.S. politics, unfortunately, and even some divisions within the two leading parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. This visit, I think, will be strongly contrasted with a previous visit he had in 2015 when he addressed a joint session of Congress. Back then in 2015, the focus was strongly on the Middle East, on the Iran nuclear deal, as well as the fact that the United States was fighting a campaign against the Islamic State. Netanyahu comes in 2024 at a time that is quite curious, actually, because Americans and American voters aren't really all that focused on the Middle East these days, including the Gaza war in most recent weeks, because we're distracted by our own internal political turmoil and uncertainty here. So he'll get a spotlight for a brief period of time. I think Netanyahu is likely to get stronger ovations and applauses from the Republicans. For those Democrats who show up, I think the response will be much more muted. And yes, even though the initial invitation was started by the Republicans in Congress this time around, the Democratic leadership also joined in inviting Netanyahu. Most of the top leaders will be there. Biden and Netanyahu, I think, will meet. And I think all of that is trying to stage manage the image of the United States working closely together with Israel, despite some serious differences on policy when it comes to the Gaza war, Iran, and other things. So it'll be an interesting time. I don't think it'll get as much attention as the 2015 visit will, just in part because of so much that's going on here in the United States.
Now, you mentioned the ongoing political turmoil here in the United States. We know that Joe Biden has dropped out of the presidential race. How will Netanyahu's message be different? Kamala Harris will be sitting right behind him as the vice president when Netanyahu is speaking to Congress. How will he change his message? How does it change his calculations?
It's unclear at this moment because Biden's dropout happened less than 24 hours ago. And I think, you know, Harris is likely to focus, even though she'll attend Netanyahu's speech, she's going to focus the balance of her time trying to win support from the Democratic Party to win the nomination formally. And then she'll be very busy campaigning. So unlikely that she'll play much of a foreign policy role. So Netanyahu is still going to be speaking to the American public and also looking to Biden as the current leader. And he's a man that has known Biden for decades, and they have a long history.
Brian Katulis is a senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the Middle East Institute. Mr. Katulis, thanks so much for your analysis. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
In a related story, there was a major escalation in conflict between Yemen, Iran-backed Houthi militia, and Israel in recent days. After months of trying to strike Israel with drones and missiles, a Houthi drone, for the first time, penetrated Israeli airspace and killed a civilian early on Friday in a long-range strike on Tel Aviv. Israel responded with an unprecedented major attack on Yemen, using fighter jets to hit port facilities in the Houthi-controlled town of Hodeidah, where authorities reported several deaths from the attack. The Houthis quickly vowed to retaliate. Fabian Hinz is a Germany-based military researcher for the International Institute for Security Studies. He spoke to my colleague Michael Lippin and said the Houthis are likely to use the same kind of long-range drone attack again.
Now, the problem is, from the Houthi perspective, that the Israeli defenses are really good. So it will be difficult to penetrate Israeli defenses. They've managed to do so with the Tel Aviv strike. Apparently, there was an oversight, and the Israelis probably did not expect the Houthi attack coming from the Mediterranean, which was enabled by the Houthis increasing the range of one of their drone designs. But still, now that the Israelis come prepared and will expect an attack from that direction, penetrating Israeli defenses will be really hard for the Houthis.
How do you assess the Israeli counterstrike on Yemen on Saturday that hit the Yemeni port of Hodeidah, where there was a fuel depot that ignited and created those massive fires that many of us have seen the images of? How does a strike like that affect the Houthis' capabilities?
I think the Israeli strike was intended to work on several levels. First, they attack a very critical piece of infrastructure within Houthi-controlled Yemen. In order to make the Houthis feel the price for the attack they did. Whether that works is a good question, because the Houthis are incredibly hard to deter, much harder to deter than other actors in the region. Then there's a symbolic level, just seeing this major attack and the balls of fire in Hodeidah. That has an impact of its own. I mean, a lot of these military confrontations in the region are quite psychological and quite political in nature. But finally, that I would say there's also a direct connection to the Houthi attacks, because there have been reports that some of the weaponry the Houthis have received and that they've used against Israel might not have only arrived in Yemen via smuggling routes, but also directly via the port of Hodeidah.
Did you detect any specific damage from the Israeli strike to these port facilities that would bring in Iranian weapons?
So the Israelis have released footage showing the strike on a crane that would be used to unload ships and unload containers coming from ships. So there's a piece of infrastructure that would be used in such cases. But then, of course, that poses other problems, because Houthi-controlled Yemen is quite dependent on the port of Hodeidah, not only when it comes to Iranian missile supplies, but also when it comes to foodstuff and other critical material.
How do you see this Israel-Houthi conflict progressing? Was the back and forth that we saw over the past few days a kind of one-off escalation in your view, or do you think this higher intensity fighting could be sustained?
So I think when you assess the prospects of further escalation, you always have to think about the will to further escalate and the capabilities. And I think the Houthis are ready to escalate further, but they just don't have the capabilities to massively increase their attacks against Israel. They've already launched quite a lot of attacks using different types of missiles and drones that have not been able to penetrate Israeli defenses. They now had one lucky shot from their perspective, but it's difficult for me to see how they could use new, more capable weaponry or much larger numbers in order to overcome Israeli defenses. I think the real potential for trouble when it comes to the Houthis still lies in the Red Sea and in their attacks on shipping.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Fabian Hinz from the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Across the Red Sea from Yemen, civilians in Sudan have suffered horrendous levels of violence during more than a year of conflict between the army and a rival paramilitary force, facing repeated attacks, abuse, and exploitation by both sides. This, according to aid group Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, known as Doctors Without Borders in English. Vicky Hawkins is one of their general directors.
The warring parties in Sudan have been inflicting horrendous levels of violence on people since the war started in April of last year. The report sheds light on the direct and deadly impact of the war on the people of Sudan, which has left the country's health service largely in ruins.
The physical and mental wounds of violence have been exacerbated by the collapse of the health system and the lack of an international humanitarian response, MSF said in a report. MSF added that in camps and gathering sites where refugees and displaced people have sought safety, patients have recounted horrific stories of inhuman treatment and violence perpetrated by armed groups on civilians. Accounts describe systematic cases of forced eviction, looting, and arson, it said. The report went on to say that sexual and gender-based violence are pervasive but underreported because of fear of stigma and silence for fear of retaliation and a lack of protection. Meanwhile, in Bangladesh, army forces patrolled the streets in the capital, Dhaka, on Monday as an indefinite curfew remained in place after clashes between student protesters and security forces have killed at least 147 people. Student protesters have given the government 48 hours to release detained protest leaders, lift the curfew, and reopen universities that have been closed since last Wednesday. Thousands were injured in last week's protests when students took to the streets to demand reforms to a quota system that governs the distribution of government jobs. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.